Climate, Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. Welcome, everyone.
All of us going to have a meeting now?
Yes, all of us together are going
to
listen to the Pollution Control
here.
Agency. Usually once we start, people arrive.
They're self-joy.
So we better get moving. So we've got Mr. Schirkenbach, Lyle Mueller, and other division directors and assistant commissioners are also here as needed. So Assistant Commissioner Schirkenbach, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, my name, I'm Acting Deputy Commissioner Tim Schirkenbach of the PCA, and with me is Lyle Mueller, Finance Manager, and also we have a great supporting cast here. So hopefully as a male, I'm smart enough if I don't know the answer actually to ask for help.
No comment.
Yeah. Let's go. Next slide here. Again, the presentation overview. Again, in this amount of time, we'll try to keep moving through quick, but certainly we'll focus on the questions as they come up, Madam Chair. Again, three main areas. We'll have a little discussion on PCA mission and our strategic plan, a little discussion on the agency design and structure, and then we'll get into the budget detail. And basically, you see here the different items we'll cover. A lot of those are the same kind of categories we cover in our strategic plan. Next slide. Our mission, working with Minnesotans to protect, conserve, and improve our environment and enhance our quality of life. The big thing I want to say here is actually in 2005, the PCA was combined with the Office of Environmental Assistance to create a new organization. So at that time, since that time, we've been trying to work to integrate those activities together. And again, the agency, an environmental agency, but dealing with a lot of regulatory functions, when we brought the Office of Environmental Assistance, that kind of shifted things to deal with issues that relate to assistance, education, and those type of things. So we've been working to make sure that we are functioning as one organization as we move forward. The strategic plan, it's basically, we think it's important to have a plan that we're working with. So everybody kind of has a sense of the direction we're going in and how they fit in. Our strategic plan has five sections: responsibility to protect our environment, clean air, land supports healthy ecosystems, clean, sustainable surface and groundwater, and excellence in operations. So that's kind of the structure we have. Each section has goals and measurable objectives, and you'll be hearing more about those goals as we go through the different media areas as far as the budget is concerned. Next one I just wanted to talk about is the agency design and structure. And I had mentioned, we can go to the next slide here, that really shows you the regional offices, and that's part of our structure. We have about 200 and some staff, over 900 plus staff in the agency as a whole, and about 200 of them out in our regional offices. But the big thing I want to mention here, too, is I said that in 2005, OEA came to the agency. We then, in 2006, looked at our structure and made some modifications and coming up with the structure we now have today. And the big thing we tried to do is make it understandable and accessible to our external customers and stakeholders, the people that need to work with us. And so what we ended up with is divisions such as industrial, municipal, prevention and assistance, remediation. Simple names help people know who they should be contacting, depending upon what area of regulatory control or permitting that they need to do. So that helps us. We then also do have a regional division, and this is basically where environmental programs, products and services for feedlots, watershed organizations, and other programs are delivered. So what we try to do is we do have a lot of our staff centralized simply because we have so many different programs. It's more efficient to have those centralized so we can really have the flexibility to deal with the workload as it comes in. But we also try to have a strong regional presence. So you can see the fact that we have 8 overall offices and seven of them are out in regional. I just wanted to mention again, one of the things we're working on is I think our agency has always been strong in the idea of, are we doing the right things and are we doing them well? And right now, we're looking at, we understand with this tight budget problem the state has, we are continually looking at, again, that idea of our priorities and are we doing the work well and efficiently with limited resources, or knowing that in the future we're going to have limited resources. So are we right now have a process in place to relook at what we're doing and our priorities, and it fit well with coming forward with this FY 10 and 11 biennial budget. But again, I think we're proud of the fact that we are continually looking at the way we're doing our work and wondering if and how we can improve. And again, that idea of then using technology and partners as we work in the future. Again, certainly know as we get in the water area, that's something that's fragmented in the way there's a lot of different agencies, both at the state level and local level involved. So we always try to figure out how we can make sure that we're having those pieces fit together in an optimal way as far as doing the most work, getting the most results with the resources that we're using. Just wanted to talk briefly about the governance and partnership structure that we look at as an agency. That, again, it's not just what's happening inside. It's, again, these different governance issues. Again, the agency is unique in that we have a citizens board. It's a 9-member citizens board. The chair of that board is the commissioner of the agency, Paul Eager. Also, I wanted to say, as we have the partnership with US EPA, I think as compared to a lot of state agencies, there is a strong environmental framework at the national level that has an impact on the state of Minnesota and the PCA as we're operating. So there's been major federal laws going back to the 70s and the 80s, the Clean Air Act in 1970, the Clean Water Act in 72. You had Superfund laws coming in early 80s. You had the hazardous waste rules. So again, we certainly have a big focus on the state, but also, as in the past, there is a federal structure. So sometimes we are delegated and work, and we are the agent in the state that basically administers those federal programs. But there's still that federal framework that does exist that is very important to us. The other big thing is, again, our partnership with the other state agencies and other local partners. We have very important to us. We spend a lot of time, and we will continue to spend a lot of time working with other agencies in the water area, DNR, Health, Florida Water and Soil Resources, Department of Agriculture, Health Department, and working with locals. Again, in the solid waste area, basically solid waste authorities and programs are carried out at the county level. So basically we work hand-in-hand with the counties and helping and make sure that we're doing a job for the state. So the partnerships are critical. And that's one of the things we focus on with our new employees, understanding it's not just about their technical skills, it's also about their ability to work with others. Because in a lot of these, it's not just our lead where we have authority. It's basically in a lot of them being good followers and contributors to other efforts where others are the lead. And we'll talk about that as we get into the water program, especially in what's happening with impaired waters and the importance of the local presence and the local leadership on those programs. Also, I just wanted to make sure we do use advisory groups. So it's one thing we think it's important. We have the Citizens Board that I think always keeps us in touch with what's kind of the views on the streets and perspectives from a citizen level. But certainly we know in individual program areas we need those advisory groups. So we really understand the impact of our programs on those that are involved and also what we should know about what's important to them. So we make sure that we're heading in the right direction as we're even establishing or redesigning our program efforts.
Does that Environmental Education Advisory Board, does that still exist?
I'm told
that was sunsetted.
No, it still exists, and actually we have the authority and kind
we'll
of lead
check.
That effort. That's important to us because, yes, a very big thing. Next one. Just now what we will do is go into, again, the budget details, so we'll start going through these. And, again, these basically somewhat parallel the elements of our strategic plan, except for the idea that it also cover the budgetary change items. This is about the budget, and also talk a little bit about the federal stimulus and how it affects the agency's programs. First, 50,000-foot view of the agency budget. Again, our budget for the biennium, as recommended by the governor, is $356 million. And again, what you can see here is we wanted to talk about where is that money coming. You can see, again, right now the major funding source we now deal with is the Environmental Fund. And this came about in 2002 where we had a fund consolidation. And we felt prior to that, in many ways, our priorities were somewhat dictated by the revenue source or the funding source. And we felt that it was important if we were really going to have the agility and ability to kind of focus on the priorities that we felt, the legislature felt, citizens felt we should be dealing with, we had to have more flexibility. So it was the idea of coming up with this fund consolidation, and that is our largest fund right now, 37%. We also have a remediation fund. Again, we'll get into that, why it still costs a lot to clean up and continue the task of finishing cleanup of a lot of the sins of our past, where we did things in the way we shouldn't have, and now we need to clean those up, and that's 22%. And again, the big thing is the general fund in proposed FY 10 and 11 is 6%, and 12% is federal funds. And finally, as we'll get into on the water, 11% of the overall budget is the water fund that we'll be talking about. This is kind of showing you the budget trends. And again, kind of hard to look at with all these different patterns. But what we wanted to do is make sure it could be printed out in black and white without creating problems. And so, but the big story here is, I think, a couple. One is, right now, 60% of our authorized spending is from environmental and remediation funds. And if you look back to the 1980s, at that time, the general fund and federal funds each accounted for roughly half of our agency's budget. So that's quite a shift of what's happening in the state on dealing with it. Right now, again, governor's recommended budget, 6% of the funding is from the federal fund, 4% is from federal. And clean water funds will account for 10%.
Mr. Schirkenbach, I'm just trying to look at that little chart.
Yes.
The one in the bar chart in the latest column, it looks like the only bar that's actually shrinking is the general fund. The little on your slide, the third one down. So that's just the general fund.
Yep. That is
everything
the
else
general
is
fund.
Growing. Mm-hmm. Well, not everything else is growing.
Yeah,
same
in relative terms, but that's a very good point. One. And again, this kind of breaks it down by programs. And again, understanding people, we think of them in the media areas, and this shows the different programs. A few things to highlight. Again, the land program is large, and that because it contains funding for several large cleanup projects, such as the Washington County Landfill, Western Lake Superior Sanitary District. Again, the environmental assistance and cross-media programs, you see that's there, that we use that terminology now, EACM, another acronym. Again, that's a reasonable amount of money, and that really involves, again, the consolidation, the fact of the Office of Environmental Assistance coming into the agency. So a lot of the activities under that funding area are, again, coming from the OEA activities when they merged it in with the agency in 2005. Another big thing is you'll see that the water program is basically a large piece, and as it should be. In a water-rich state such as Minnesota, you're basically looking at about 33% of the staff are found in this program.
But that, Mr. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, Madam Chair.
I thought you were finished with your sentence. Apologize. But this is the governor's recommended budget, so compare the water dollars from the current fiscal year to that $105.5 million.
Lyle, I'll turn to Mr. Mueller.
Adam Mueller, too.
Yeah. Could we look at the other?
Madam Chair, we're looking to see whether we have the numbers from last year.
All right.
And I think we get into that as far as, like, for the impaired waters program, or we have it. I don't know if we have the numbers
readily available.
We haven't really seen that aggregate number before, so that would be useful to have.
That's what we'll get, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. We'll be working on it and getting to you. When we go. Is it okay to move forward?
Please.
And we can okay, and what I wanted to cover just briefly is, again, talk about the money, but again, at the agency, a key thing that we're trying to focus on, I think we've done a reasonable job, we need to get better, is in the last 10 years focusing on the idea of results. How do we measure and how do we report out on results? And I wanted to share with you, in the last 10 years, working with other states, and working with the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, we've been using a four-tiered environmental performance indicator system. And I wanted to share. The first tier is one that I think is obvious, kind of that idea of what are the environmental conditions that can include health effects on individuals, those type of things. We certainly know that's the tier we'd like to be reporting at on everything. The second one is behavioral outcomes. A lot of what we do as an agency is risk management. And it's really then changing behaviors of industry, point source dischargers, organizations, governmental bodies, and others. And so we also have measures that get into behavior. A lot of that is compliance rates. If they have a permit, are they in compliance? Or how are they meeting best management practices, those type of things. The third category is Tier 3. Again, not quite as valuable as far as really getting the results as agency activities and outputs. And this is where so often agencies were totally or almost totally 20 years ago, where you said, here's how many permits, here's how many inspections and other things. That's good to know, but again, it doesn't give you the final results. And then finally, a thing we do use, though, too, which gets back to doing the right things and doing them as well, is productivity measures and efficiency measures. In other words, how many hours does it take to get a permit out? How many hours does it do to do an inspection? What do you gain by consolidating or integrating inspections together, coordinating activities with another agency? So we like to do that. The big thing I'd like to say is any system we will give you, show you, is going to have a combination of needs. We like to be moving up and get to Tier 1, Tier 2 as much as we can. There are limitations. The big thing on Tier 1 is twofold, time and expense. Time, when you're dealing with the environment, when we get into impaired waters and other things, you can be doing the right things in a watershed for a long period of time before you're going to actually see the water change or water quality parameters change. It's just the way the environmental systems go. So even though that's where you'd like to be, we'll talk about the idea of our 10-year plan for rotating around watersheds. We think by that type of a plan, you are keeping track of data that, again, will give you timely results but deals with the reality of how long it takes for the environment to clean itself up and react to those type of things. We will also, there's the cost factor. When you're going out and checking the environment and gathering information that's really at the right level, a lot of times it can be very costly, and that's one of the things we'll be talking about in the whole idea of our impaired waters program, how important monitoring and assessment is, and what we're trying to do to get the most information, data that we need to have a good way to run the program, but do it with the dollars that we have. And I think we've staff come up with a very creative and innovative way to do that, and we'll cover that when we get into that area. So again, this is what we try to do, and we're very, again, proud of our efforts. Again, we're not perfect in a lot of these things, and again, we continue trying to push ourselves, and we hope if you have questions or concerns yourself, we hear those because we think we need to know we're falling short. I'd also like to say priorities. I said, again, doing the right things. And doing the right things is about having priorities. And we just wanted to share. And usually when you lay out priorities, it's not a perfect roadmap or formula, but it's more like a compass. And we wanted to share right now with our staff, with people on the outside, here's how we talk about our priorities. The first one is water protection and restoration activities. Given, again, the impaired waters program and that, we know, and we'll be talking about that a lot today, this is a key priority. A second one, though, goes with the idea of the governor's emphasis on the whole Next Generation Energy Act and the idea of how the state is dealing with energy, energy efficiency, and also climate change. And so we have as our priority how in all of our programs we're starting not just to deal with the pollutants and the issues on in the past, how can we make sure that now climate change is on our agenda as well. The third one, and this is one that again gets to the agility of an agency, and that is no matter we have our core programs, I'll talk about that as the fourth item, but nowadays, and I've been in this business 37 years, and what's been amazing to me is again, on one side we tell people how successful we are, and at the other side they read in the newspaper that there's a new issue with this pollutant or that pollutant, and they wonder how can that be. And it's just the fact is there are, with our technology now, our monitoring efforts, and our basic scientific advancements, we just know of things that 12 years ago, 20 years ago, we didn't know about. And PFCs is one of those. And so what we always need to be doing is the priority is how are we agile as an agency, not just to take care of business on the core programs, but also how can we can be moving ahead on the new issues. Endocrine disruptors is another one. Finally, though, we have as a priority the core programs, and that's the idea that we will only be able to deal with these other issues if we're continually focusing on improvement and efficiencies in dealing with our core programs. Also, if you let those slide, if we slide from all the gains we've made by permitting and reducing emissions from water sources, point air sources and others, then waste all the effort that. So we know the core programs, we have to continue to be accountable, but we also have to continue to find ways of being more efficient in delivering core program services that are required, because then we have resources that we can use to deal with these other three areas. So that's kind of what our compass looks like as far as the four corners of our priorities that we're. Now I'd like to go into meeting areas, Madam Chair. And the first one is the land. And what it is our vision here is Minnesota land supports healthy ecosystems and sustainable land uses. And really, we kind of divide this in three goal areas. One is, how can we start looking at solid waste and other waste as a resource? So managing waste in order to conserve materials, resources, and energy. In other words, again, from the very upstream element of the way we produce and use products, how can we manage helps us save energy and conserve resources. Second is how we minimize the release of contaminants to or from the land. And the third one is the cleanup. Store contaminants. Next one I'm going to show you is kind of a way we look at this. And this is, again, we use that idea of no model is perfect, but some are useful. And we use this model, you'll see over on the right-hand side, of looking at our different component activities from the standpoint of prevention, management, and cleanup. We do that because we know that, again, it's always best if you are preventing things in the first place. So we try to make sure that across these different media areas, we're at least keeping track of how are we doing as far as allocating our resources. Because so often you can have the urgent, which are the cleanup issues or the management issues, make you lose focus on the important, like the preventive. So we do this. It's not a perfect model. When you look at the components, somebody could argue are in the right category. But for us, it's more about informing us as we're looking ahead and doing our strategic planning. Are we forgetting about the prevention side of things? Are we preventing some of the management issues that we could be dealing with? Again, it also tells you, though, when you look in an area like this, cleanup is a big element. We have a lot of resources going there, and it's just that idea that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. We have cleanup issues we have to deal with in this state, but it's very expensive to do so. So, again, we have to keep reminding ourselves of that.
Mr. Schirkenbach? Oh, go ahead. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you. Is it Mr. Mueller?
Mr. Schirkenbach.
Thank you.
Tim.
I'm just curious about the prevention. What are you doing for prevention besides hazardous waste and in respect to hazardous waste and pollution?
Well, actually,
prevention?
The whole hazardous waste system is kind of a cradle-to-grave approach saying that no release is allowed. So kind of anybody who has what is designated as hazardous waste has to basically track and record how they're handling it from when it's generated to when it's finally disposed of. So we see that as a prevention thing because you're keeping it out of the environment the whole time it's being generated or handled. So that's one of them.
Senator Rowe.
Madam Chair, Schirkenbach?
Mr.
Schirkenbach?
The assistant commissioner, but that's kind of long.
That's
so
easier.
Acting
I'm
assistant commissioner.
With the acting.
I'll use the title. So I'm just curious because I'm getting a lot of emails about the new fluorescent light bulbs.
Yes.
So how are we managing that in the whole cycle?
And actually, that's one we'll get into, which goes to the whole idea of product stewardship, and that's kind of under that category of pollution prevention. And what we're trying to do is we have a number of categories in the state of things that we're trying to deal with, all the way from CFLs, compact fluorescent lamps, to paint, to electronics and all those. And what we're trying to do is work with industry and the idea of product stewardship being you go back to producers and retailers and all the way along the line and looking at the responsibility of everybody in that chain being responsible for trying to figure out how to reduce the amount of waste you're generating and also how do you reduce the amount of toxics in that waste that also is part of the risk management. And on CFLs, what we have right now is that we are working with Great River Energy and another environmental group to try to come up with a strategy in order to deal with adding to the capacity of the household hazardous waste programs, but looking at retailers. Actually, we're working with Menards and Home Depot and Ace Hardware to try to see if we can come up and establish a system of payback and reverse distribution. So that's what we're trying to do. The thing we're finding is, and again, we've also generated a product stewardship framework. That was one of the requests from the legislature. We produced that and reported that back to the legislature on January 15th of this year. Also, the idea of coming up with an overall generic framework for dealing with this. But what we are finding is each product has its own unique factors. as far as the idea of weight, the form it comes in, how it's generated. So we're finding out that, that there's some similarities to how you can deal with these, but it almost, you have to go product by product. So we've got a number of different, we now have a stakeholder group dealing with beverage containers. There's group meetings on following up on the electronics law and what happened on that. There's a paint product stewardship group, and there's some proposed legislation relative to paint product stewardship, and we're working with this group on CFL. So we've got a number of tentacles all trying to work on that part. And a very good point, Senator, I think that's on the pollution prevention part. How do you prevent it from getting in the waste stream in the first place?
Senator Rummel.
Just one more follow-up. Talk to me a little bit about the cans. What is the issue with the cans?
Beverage containers, and actually the beverage containers, you have the three different types. You have the metal aluminum, you have the glass, and you have the plastic. And what we are now doing is, in a couple years ago, the beverage container industry came forward, and they were concerned as we came up with our 2007 solid waste policy report, that in there we talked about container deposit. And the idea that, and if you look across the country, the states that have gotten up in that 85-90% return have been those that have some type of container deposit. But with the beverage container industry, they said, well, they'd rather, since we've invested in a voluntary system, they'd rather work with us to try to see if we could make some significant changes in the voluntary system and move up and get an 80% recycling level. That's what we came up with. I'll be honest, the industry was a little concerned about that being too aggressive. We now are just completing, coming up with a report with that group. And we also partnered with the state of Wisconsin, so we could almost look, knowing that we share some metropolitan areas such as Duluth, Superior, and down here, the Twin Cities. So we work with Wisconsin. We're going to have reports by the middle of the month or the end of this month that'll give what we think we could do and how far we think it would take us in recycling beverage containers, glass, metal, and plastic.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Schirkenbach, I was going to ask about the cleanup. You talk about outcomes, but what I'm interested in knowing is how are we making progress on cleaning up some of the Superfund sites, some of the closed landfill sites. We keep seeing the same list year after year of the sites that are in need of remediation. Are we making any progress there?
And Madam Chair, great idea. And why don't we go to the next slide, and I think we get into that some of the issues at a glance. You're seeing on a contaminated site cleanups. And two numbers I'd bring out of that one is on that 1,496 active Superfund and petroleum release. The big thing is, getting to your point, is 96 of those are active Superfund sites. And we do think we are moving through those. They do take a lot of time. Usually on those, it's several years. I would like to say, though, I think we have are seen around the country as making more progress on Superfund sites than just about any other state in the country. And I think sites recently that have taken more time than we thought. Reserve Mining was a site up in the along the North Shore. And we had an idea of how big it was, and it ended up costing considerably more than we had funded for. So, yes, we do think we're moving through. We have that idea. In fact, our idea is we want to get through these Superfund sites and the closed landfill sites in the next few years, because only then we'll be able to shift gears and start focusing on some of the other issues, such as product stewardship, pollution. I'll get into that a little more as we go a few pages down and talk about the budget in this area. Is that, Madam Chair?
I just heard you say you're going to try to, I thought I heard you say you're going to try to clean them all up in the next 2 years, but maybe not. A few years. Okay, well, I guess it'd be good to know sort of how much progress we can expect in this biennium.
Madam Chair, I think what we can do is actually we have something in both of those areas that projects out kind of what we see as a schedule. On it.
Okay. I'd like to see that. Thank you.
Chair and the staff. I'd be more than happy to do that. Go to the next. Go back one lot, please. The one I should say, as you see on permitting there and the tank inspections, again, I do want to point out on the permitting 393, that includes solid waste landfills, industrial waste landfills, demolition debris, and solid waste composting facilities, and even transfer stations. So there's a variety of sites that are permitted in this state that we were gotten down to limiting. We have fewer number of sites, and I think we have, again, very close regulatory overview of those sites to make sure that we're not generating future problems for other generations.
Senator Frederickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Schirkenbach, over the last couple of years, how many solid waste landfills has the agency permitted, and how many have been permitted to expand?
Madam Chair, I will look at, I don't think there's been any expanded, but not new ones. Do you want to get up, Lisa?
I don't know how many.
Okay, we can get back to you on that. There have not been that many. In fact, right now, I think, as far as solid waste facilities, there are only 21 municipal landfills in the state at this time. And so we've really gotten down as compared to several years ago. It's a small number. And again, it's I don't know if we have any expansions in the works right now, any applications. We will get back to you. Senator Fredericks and Madam Chair, we will get back to you on it.
Madam Chair, Mr. Schirkenbach, I would be interested in what the capacity of those municipal landfills are. You know, how long till they're anticipated that they would be filled, and what the need's going to be, and if there's any long-range plans for dealing with our waste stream, or what
Madam
the long-range
Chair.
Plans are.
We'll get to that. Yes, and I should say, as a result of the 2007 Solid Waste Policy Report, one of our recommendations in there as a staff, and Governor's Office accepted that, was to create a stakeholder group in order to look at the idea of where we are as a state on recycling. And I think you see that on this slide down in the bottom. Right now, our recycling rate has plateaued over the last decade, probably at about 40% of the state's garbage is recycled. And we burn about 20% as the solid waste for energy, and it contributes to our economy, but it doesn't contribute nearly as much as it would if we got further along in our system on dealing with it. So what we have is we have the stakeholder group, and the idea is now we've changed not just from looking at recycling goals and how much we can divert from landfills. We've also looked at the idea from the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, the MK report. They came up and set a goal to look at if we could reduce between 2005 and 2025 75 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent greenhouse gases. So right now, the agency, working with the Minnesota Environmental Initiative, is heading up the stakeholder group. We want to have a report from by the end of June that'll say what would need to happen in the state system in order to meet that type of a goal. And that would require significant changes. I should say, finally, one of the parameters is we focused, and one of our ideas as an agency was, we figure that there are 17 counties in the state that generate 70% of the waste. And we said if we first looked at those big pieces, and they're really around four areas. You have the metropolitan area, you have the St. Cloud area, you have the Rochester area, and you have the Duluth area. And with those 17 counties, 70% of the waste. So what we're trying to do is actually look at the specifics of those four central areas and figuring out what would need to change. And we're actually using the WARM model as we're looking at strategies. What would we need to change, and how close would it come to meet that MK goal of 75 million for the state? When you bring that down to the seven counties and the 70% waste, we've now modified, and the target prorated is 52.5 million metric tons for those 17 counties. And that's what we've tried to set up, and we hope to have the report by the end of June on what would need to change to get those type of reduction.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner. You know, I don't, you know, when you say you burn 20% of it, you know, certainly the information that we get leads us to believe that's not necessarily the most environmentally friendly thing if we don't attempt to separate, you know, what's going into that particular waste stream that we burn for energy. So is there an effort on the part of the department that encourages those facilities to separate the waste so that we aren't including those portions that are the most toxic?
Yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Kubley, certainly. That's a big thing. In fact, one of our grants we funded was for down at Red Wing, where they have a waste energy incinerator down there, is to add a processing facility up front to make sure that we're processing. But when you look at the eight facilities around the state, again, there's always been the concern that it's a competition. If you're going to waste energy, then you're losing processing of waste in order to take out the beneficial materials. And in fact, what we're seeing is the opposite. If you look at Rochester, you look at the Herc incinerator in Hennepin County, You look at the Pope Douglas County, you look at Red Wing, you look at all those have processing and a real focus on processing. And if we're going to meet our goals, one of the things on the waste management hierarchy of the state has the idea of waste to energy, but that includes processing of the material. So you're getting those things that shouldn't be burned out of there. Also, you find out in HERC, the people at HERC, I just saw a presentation a couple weeks ago, if they get glass or metal, the type of slag that creates and the operational problems it causes, there's huge benefits for them to get those type of materials out of there. So we're really seeing that the two can go hand in hand as you're moving forward. I will have to say, as you all are aware, with the folks, Neighbors Against the Burner, there were people with the idea of Rock 10 in the Midway area, there were concerns with that idea of burning. I think, though, an integrated system for the near future here, we're going to have to look at ways that we do have waste energy. And again, we're looking at that very closely in this stakeholder group we're dealing with to try to figure out and see if everybody can agree on how to account for that relative to energy, renewable energy, and relative to greenhouse gas impacts. So I think that'll be a help to try to see what difference it makes and how it does either positively or in a neutral way fit with an integrated solid waste system in the state. So,
well, on the in the context of Rock 10 and St. Paul's neighborhood dialogue about that issue, I know some of the folks called our local facility that processes the waste and asked where they would be, you know, processing it into RDF, into the pelletizing it or whatever, and they said they were told, oh, we just throw everything in there, you know. We don't do any separation before we process it into RDF. So that was what led to a lot of the concern, a belief that there really are no requirements to separate out the plastics, for example, before it's processed into some kind of a product for burning. So right. I'm not sure if that if there's any system in place to require. I don't think there's any requirements that they do that. Sounds like it's a voluntary effort that you're talking about.
Madam Chair, if I could... Actually, even for the metropolitan area, there is a requirement that the metro counties process all the waste before it goes to landfill, which would lead to that also we try to look at that in processing waste regardless of whether it goes to landfill or it goes to waste energy. The trouble with that was several years ago there was a decision, the Carboni decision, where it limited the ability of counties and government to deal with the flow control. So that created a problem on dealing with that. Now, with what's come up with the Oneida Herkimer, another decision that hopefully gives government some ability to deal with designating waste and therefore controlling the flow of waste. Hopefully we can see, and that's one of the issues we're looking at through the stakeholder group. What would need to happen in order to make sure there's adequate control over the waste so government would have some assurance of what's happening to it. So we will see. It's a complicated issue, though, and I think one that after we come up with this report, we'd be more than happy to be involved with the legislature and other staff discussions and hearings about that and understand what does it mean as far as possible changes in the future. It's a big issue.
Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I guess, well, this is more of a hypothetical thing, but you do say that, you know, the waste stream contributes, you know, nearly $3 billion to the state's economy. Well, I have a friend who suggests that we're not far away from a day when we'll be having companies applying for permits to mine the state's landfills for the recyclables that are there. And I don't know if you've had that kind of discussion or not, but I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that or about its feasibility or, you know, is that a long ways away or where are we with that?
Madam Chair, Senator Kubley. Long term, I hope, as I look, if you look at the issues we have as a society, yes, I hope long term we can look at that, even going back in on waste that we buried and look at that as a resource. I would say first, the bridge to get us there is going to be the waste we're generating right now, stuff that's going out at the curbside and everything else. So I think first, if we can figure out ways to deal with that, number one, primarily diverts it from landfills. Again, we're going to find that there's limited landfill space in the state, so it keeps it out of landfills. Then number two says, how do you make sure that you're taking beneficial materials out as much as you can upstream before you even think about something like burning the waste for the energy? However, I think what you're going to see is new technologies that are going to be out there on how you can deal with that waste and turn it into some type of gases and other things that you can use in other ways that will help both as far as on real renewable energy and also will help on any type of emissions in that. So I'd hope that I think, just if I look, and I'm not an expert in this area, but if I look at it, I think first it'll be how do we deal with the waste we're generating right now? And once we get a handle on that, who knows how far we could go as far as then even looking at waste that's already in landfill and what that means. But I think that'll be the big thing. And I think there are companies out there. I do think that's often where government needs to be involved with providing some seed money, because a lot of these, they're first risky, they're new technologies, so it's how do you get the venture capital or the money there for somebody to willing to take the risk to try some of these new technologies and see if they're working. Because usually once they're proven and somebody feels they can do it, yeah, then you're going to have people get in line to try to deal with those type of facilities. Again, just wanted to get into the budget and just show it. This is kind of by expenditures, just giving you a sense of the different funds and where we're spending their money. And you'll see here that of the overall land budget of $103.7 million, again, about over 75% of it is in the remediation fund. And there is a reduction here, and there's actually in the closed landfill program. In the past, we've been looking at a level like $30.8 million. This year, because we're seeing what we can actually are able to spend with projects that move ahead, the governor has a recommended change level that brings that down to $25.6 million. So that's the one change in that area. And so, again, this is it. Again, it comes back to that idea of cleanup is expensive, but we're trying to do in the land areas, again, keep moving up the hierarchy relative to both management and prevention activities. Next, I'd like to go to the environmental assistance and cross-media area. This is a media area that really focuses on that vision of Minnesota's take responsibility to protect our environment. And again, a lot of the activities under this area relate to two things. One is that idea of the Office of Environmental Assistance joining and coming into the agency, but also the idea that a lot of the things we do now, some of the issues we deal with, are really cross-media, and that is risk assessment work we do, some of the monitoring work we do, and other things. And so it really gets into these goals that you see. Part of it is how do we help Minnesotans buy green products and services? That's some of our activities on product stewardship. How do we get businesses to produce green products and services? And that's where we have people that provide some technical assistance. How can we get Minnesotans to act on their environmental knowledge to support healthy ecosystems? And then PCA leading the way. And I'll get into that in a couple slides, talking about we feel that we can't just talk about this for others. We have to lead the way and show that we can do it as an organization ourselves. And so, again, with this model we have of prevention, management, cleanup, you can see the different components of activities that we have over in the left hand column, and then how we kind of look at it in that categories of prevention, management, and cleanup. And these aren't perfect, but in this area it says a lot of this is about management, and it's about things such as the SCORE program, which is really where we pass through money to the counties to deal with their solid waste and recycling efforts. It's where we deal with our household hazardous waste, where we give grants out to counties and other government units that are running household hazardous waste facilities. And it's also when we do environmental review that crosses media areas. We have an environmental review staff that deals with permits regardless of media. And also we have permitting activities that relate to setting standards, doing toxics assessments, and those type of things that are required for a variety of permits, be it air or water or hazardous waste facilities. Again, some of the things that are covered under here at a glance are things, again, cross-media policy development. And this can relate to things such as even waste management, our e-waste stuff, and again, what we're doing on PFCs. We're finding on PFCs, we just put together a report on PFCs in the environment, and we've got almost every program in the agency in some way or other has some involvement in our PFC activity because it's affecting air, it's affecting land and cleanup, and we're seeing it in water, wastewater treatment plants as coming out. And also in this area, we promote use of technologies and fuels that reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And so this is like in the waste area, and even in our environmental review, we're trying to have people in the environmental review process at least identify what they see as their greenhouse gas footprint so they become aware of it. It's not regulated now, but we first think we need to become aware. They need to become aware to understand what it would mean as far as if you don't know what your footprint is, you're not going to do anything about it relative to pollution prevention or other things that may be low as far as having a reduction benefits.
Do you know, Mr. Schirkenbach, how much you spend on the whole state fair exhibit and that turbine blade and all those things that are in my district?
In your district.
Just curious.
Let me check and see if somebody's got a sense here. We can get it for you. I guess I'm not, what we can talk about is, yeah, I didn't relate probably pretty quickly. We can figure out how many staff are involved. Do we have something in the slide? I should maybe. Yeah, let's move to the next one and we can look at it. I don't know if we have the dollar figure there. Move one more and then we'll come back, if you could, please.
Oh, here we go.
One more. Yeah, right here. And then we'll come back. This is the Eco Experience, and this is just showing, we will get you the dollar figures. But again, yeah, this is a big event, 350,000 visitors. And again, the big thing there is the idea of trying to get people to come up with commitments on what they're going to do to change the environment. And we do have people that even now deal with this idea of the media impressions. We will find out, though, what the overall cost is as far as how many people we have working there. The big thing I'd like to mention there, though, is how many other organizations. And again, it shows that nearly $1 million of contributions of on-kind or in-kind and on-site contributions were made in the last one. So it's a big partnership thing. We know we can't do that alone, so we do work with others in putting it on. Anybody who's been through that, they certainly see that there's a lot of other groups that are represented as part of that.
And I think it does provide a lot of education and awareness building for the public, which is great. I don't know, I was just sort of churning through my mind thinking, how could we pay for that? Maybe you could sell some stuff there. It's great that you give the bags away and the light bulbs. I think last time I was there, you had to go through some little quiz thing, and then you got a free light bulb, and that's all really great stuff at the fair. You expect to get some free stuff, but maybe you could sell some things and make some money to help pay for it. You could probably sell a lot of stuff and people would buy it. Green products.
Sell it at cost.
Just to try to help us cover the costs.
Madam Chair, what we'll do is first get you the cost of what, right now, how we see the overall expenses, and then in the future we can take a look at that. I think, any of these things that could be self-sustaining.
Wasting their money.
I think we always have to be careful on our relationship to vendors and other things, but we can figure out how we deal with that.
Thank you.
Let's go back. So I just wanted to bring up here again some of the other things. Again, this does include environmental review and environmental education. That's big for us. And a lot of the things we now have working with greenhouse gas reductions in a lot of different areas, and also our grants and loans that we provide for environmentally innovative projects. And like I said, a lot of times the role of government is, I think, a proper role to provide seed money for some of the new innovations, because oftentimes the private sector won't take the risk unless they first see that something becomes proven and is actually practical on dealing with it.
Thank you, Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner. Give me some example of the grants that you give out and what part of the budget is that?
Okay, I think we can get...
Madam Chair, Senator, one of the bigger examples of a grant program that runs through is the SCORE grants, $14 million per year, 28 for the biennium.
Yeah, 28 for the biennium that we go out and give to counties on dealing with it. We also have part of this goes out in money that goes to MNTAP, the Minnesota Technical Assistance Program at the University of Minnesota. So money goes to them where they have student interns go out and work with companies that they do work. We also have a small amount of money that goes where we have a RETAP program now. It's Retired Engineers Technical Assistance Program, where retired engineers come back and for a very low hourly rate go out and help work with industries. So I think we're trying to look in a number of new ways on how we can do these. And right now we just have started discussions, possibly looking forward, work with AmeriCorps.
Yeah.
Where they also deal with where they come up at stipend of, I think it's $11,400, somebody working full time goes out, and we're trying to see how that can also help us in some of these technical assistance and energy conservation areas as well. So we have a whole variety of different things, but we can get you a list of some of the other grants that we have, Senator and Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Schirkenbach. you know, it's my understanding that these new hybrid buses that are being used by the city or, you know, that being made by Cummins Diesel together with Eaton Corporation, I believe it is, they're putting out a hybrid bus that has a 40% improvement in their mileage. And from what we gathered from speaking with people from the city of Minneapolis, they, you know, saved about 40% of the fuel on the last half of the bus's lifespan. I wonder if your department might be willing to engage in a conversation with the companies that are doing that to look at the possibility of making a school bus that has that kind of mileage improvement. It seems to me there would be a market for that, and it would allow school districts to save a pretty significant amount of money in my part of the state where they have a lot of miles to cover.
Sure. Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Kubley, I think that's a great idea. We can certainly look into that and how we can serve as a kind of a bridge of information to others that could take advantage of that type of technology. Again, I wanted to just talk a little bit about a idea of us modeling the way as an agency. So one of the things we're doing is saying, as an organization of over 900 people and with our different facilities around the state, what do we need to do in order to show that we can model the way? So we've come up with kind of a sustainability initiative that looks at four areas where we set goals for ourselves as an organization. And one is on energy efficiency. And what we're looking at that is the green buildings and the information technology improvements. And we've set a 30% reduction goal in energy use by 2013. So that's one of the areas on the energy. On source reduction, we're looking at paper. And even though we think we've done a lot as far as looking at copies on both sides and reduction in paper and recycling of paper, what we have is we're looking at a 10% reduction goal by 2011 relative to paper. We're also looking at vehicle miles traveled relative to both doing our work and getting to and from work. So what we've set up is this goal of 375,000 pounds of CO2 equivalent reduction, and that equates to roughly 260,000 miles per year savings or reduction in what we have as fleet miles right now. And that also includes some saving, again, in commuter trips to and from. I'm proud to say we have a MetroPass system at our agency, and a number of people at the agency do take the bus to and from work, and it's something we do promote and also rideshare programs as well. And finally, you see on that slide, closed landfills. What we're looking at is five candidate sites that we could look at for either capturing methane for energy production or possibly use of solar-powered equipment for doing some of the things where energy is used at some of these sites. And that's used preventing the off-gas coming from these landfills and others. There are pumps and air blowers and other things, and they do take energy. So what we're looking at is how we can model the way by using solar power on those as well. Next, and again, some of the other outcomes in this area. One is the Project Green Fleet. And Senator Kugley, you mentioned that idea of buses and that. And there have been, there's roughly 4,000 diesel school buses in the state, and 1,200 of those school buses have been retrofitted. And with that, we've seen roughly a 30% reduction in fine particulate emission from those. And this is part of that partnership that the agency has been involved with of Clean Air Minnesota's Project Green Fleet, which saw its inception in 2005. Also, the technical assistance savings. As a result of working with the different organizations in that, we've seen over the last few years this idea of $4.8 million savings in operating costs. Again, waste is waste in a lot of different areas. A lot of what we're seeing are changes, are things that can actually help save money. We're seeing 18.3 million gallons of water saved and 17.1 million pounds of waste saved as a result of some of these efforts over the last years. So, again, that's something we need, I think, to get better on our measurement systems to really show how much FTEs or man hours are going into those. But I think right now we've got some good measures in place, and we hope to get better as we do that so we can start to see what are really the results of some of those efforts. Again, we've gone through this one. If we can move forward, Lyle. Again, just overall budget, and again, this is showing expenditures by fund relative to this area that we categorize as environmental assistance and cross media. And again, $88.4 million is the overall amount. And as you can see, again, majority of that is in the environmental fund. That's the fund where we have a lot of, again, flexibility. We use that so we can kind of shift as we see moving priorities. I'd also like to say, though, you see that 28.6 there for the federal funds, a big piece of this, and that's basically where we get money from the EPA through a kind of a block grant approach. It's called our Performance Partnership Agreement, or grant. And what that is we set up and have a very detailed work plan, a lot of different goals covering a lot of different areas, and this is where we deliver on that. And as a result, over the biennium, we project getting $25.3 million from the federal government to continue all kinds of different activities in that area.
Mr. Schierkenbach, when we moved the OEA over to PCA a couple years ago, it was supposed to remain as a separate entity in the agency. When did this become EACM or whatever it is? EACM, yeah.
Madam Chair, no. The idea was that it would be brought in. I think the idea was we would make sure that the missions and services that OEA was providing would be maintained, but I think the idea was we felt had the flexibility to work it in with our organization so we could optimize, again, what we were providing with services. And so a lot of it we've integrated in technical assistance, pollution prevention activities, and other things within the organization. Does that answer you? This just shows, again, the expenditures by funds. And I think the one thing I want to mention here is there is a change item here in the environmental fund, and that's an increase of $1 million, $500,000 for each of the years, and that increases the grants that are going out to the counties. And that's the SCORE money going out to the counties. It was at $14 million per year. It's now going to go up to $15.5 million. Actually, given how much effort the counties put in, that's a small percentage of what they are spending, but we think it's important to continue to contribute to their activities. And again, especially given that we are working with the counties also on this redesign project to try and look at if we can somewhat reduce or modify the burden of counties on reporting and other things. So we hope to do that as well. But we feel that this is a good investment of some additional funds from the environmental fund area. Next, I want to move on to air. And again, the vision here is Minnesota's air is clean and clear. And again, clean air means healthy people as well. And it also means clean water and other things. Certainly, as we understand from mercury, a lot of the mercury that gets in is from deposition and is coming from the air. I'd like to go back in this one to remind ourselves, though, that as you look at the goals we have there, it goes back to really the 1970 Clean Air Act, established standards to protect public health in six key pollutant areas: sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, particulate, ozone, carbon monoxide, and lead. And Minnesota currently meets all standards for these air pollutants. So I think I'm proud of the effort in the state. And if you look at other states surrounding us in that, I think it's something that's important and we take seriously here. However, we still do have unhealthy days, and they're primarily caused by fine particulates and ozone. And these two things are things that the wind can carry for hundreds of miles. So sometimes unhealthy conditions in our state can be caused by pollution that's formed and blown in from other states. So it's something we need to keep in mind. This is an area you'll see on that third goal, though, or the second goal, where Minnesotans will reduce its emissions of regional and global pollutants. This is where we start to also shift gears from dealing with those priority pollutants and NESHAP's hazardous emissions. We're also now dealing with climate change gases, and that's CO2. So this is where we are shifting. Now, climate change and greenhouse gases is something of concern. One of the things this brings up is right now coal-fired power plants are a major source of gas associated with climate change. So as we see what we've done with those, dealing with mercury, dealing with SO2 and other pollutants, again, now we're coming on to look at them relative to the idea of CO2 emissions and how they contribute to climate change in the state and in the region and in the world.
Senator Saxhock.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, we were talking about power plants and the contributors to, our air pollution. Have we done any research or done any thinking about how sustainable forests and sustainable prairies, what effect they may have on our air and in terms of improving it? We know that some of our pollution is coming in from, North Dakota and China and everything else, and I'm just wondering if there's any you have any...
And Madam Chair, Senator Sacksock, relative to the idea of CO2, or are you talking about other pollutants as well, or...
Well, I think all things, but CO2, you know... Okay.
Sequestration.
Yeah, sequestration, exactly.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's, as we look, and as I think the climate change group looked at that, that was something that was considered. I think if we want to get into that, I have David Thornton, who is really our expert on that. We could get him up here if you have some questions, or we could follow up with some information on how that was looked at by the Climate Change Advisory Group.
Yeah, well, Madam Chair, we can do it at a different time. We don't have to do it today.
Well,
unless you're interested.
Question. And I don't know if anyone's tracking, measuring
okay.
that.
If we want, David?
Members, we're going to do our best. I think it's great. There's so many good questions, so we'll just keep going and get as far as we can today. If we run out of time, we'll just invite you back. Mr. Thornton.
Madam Chair, David Thornton, Assistant Commissioner at the PCA. There has been a working group that includes a lot of folks at the University of Minnesota, carbon sequestration, I'll call it the task force. I don't recall the exact name. And they're looking into those exact questions. DNR is taking the lead for that. And some of the initial recommendations that they had, that this group had, was let's protect the forests and wetlands that we have right now. Let's do a better inventory of the lands where this might be an option, where additional protection might be needed, and where we have the opportunity to do reforestation or afforestation, or allowing natural prairies to come back in. Let's do an inventory there. And then, as important, but a little more squishy in terms of science, what are the actual benefits that we get from changing the way we manage these lands? Because there's a lot of argument in the scientific community about what kind of benefit you get from carbon sequestration. We know that it's positive. It's a question of how positive. And so DNR is working on that, and Mark Lindquist from their commissioner's office would be a great person to talk to get more details on that.
So, Madam Chair, what we have here then is kind of something in the works. Mm-hmm. And so that's good. That's what I needed to know.
That was something that we put in law a year ago, maybe, and funded the study.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'll continue on. On this slide, again, with that approach we take on looking at how we even see the activities, you see the air component activities on the one side. Again, the majority of the activity here is really in the area of permitting. And I'll cover that, and also the development of the air quality index so we can keep people informed of the air quality. And I also have another slide that shows kind of what we've seen as far as the progress in different communities in the state. As far as the activity at a glance, what you'll see is, again, we have roughly 3,700 facilities that we permit and then also basically kind of do compliance enforcement activities on to make sure they're complying. We have strategies to reduce air pollution from small and mobile sources. Again, we often use that term non-point source, but this is the area we're talking about. We have a lot of small sources and mobile sources that, again, impact the air quality in different areas of the state. We have our index. And then we have dealing with the idea of ozone and particulate reduction areas. And what you see here is even that last strategy to reduce regional and global air pollutants, you see that little picture there. And what that really is it's split in half, and it's showing the difference of clear days and days when you're seeing regional haze up in the northeastern part of the state. And this is one of the things that is caused by the idea of particulate and ozone. And that's why this is one of the things in that part of the state is part of our reduction efforts is coming up with a plan of dealing with that. And the mining facilities up there in that area are part of that as well. And so that's something that shows as we keep advancing, as their air quality gets better, we're dealing with other issues. And one of these is even the aesthetic thing, that as people go out and use our beautiful outdoors and that, they should be able to have that high, clear, visible day that they can look out and see the resources that we do have.
Well, I think there's more than aesthetics there. I think it affects people's health and respiratory
diseases. It does
diseases.
As well, but yep. Yeah. But even the way it's talked about from regional haze, but Madam Chair, that's a very good point. And again, what we also have is just that we have 45 ambient air quality monitoring sites throughout the state. So again, that idea of it costs. It's a considerable cost to the state, but something that's very important, that we really are monitoring our air, and we have a variety of different sites where we're taking continuous emission monitoring and other types of things. So that's a very important part. And we also have a lab over at our agency that helps us deal with that and keeps the cost of that activity down. Next one talks just a little bit about some key outcomes. The greenhouse gas emissions, I wanted to mention, under the Next Generation Energy Act, the legislature outlined a 15% emission reduction goal from 2005 levels that was to be achieved by 2015. And with this idea of having a greenhouse gas emission reduction report, the idea is between 2005 and 2006, we actually saw a reduction in greenhouse gases of about 2 million tons of CO2 equivalent. So looking at the goal, Minnesota is on track to meet that goal. So at least over the short term, we're actually seeing that we've turned the corner on dealing with that. Some of the other outcomes we're looking for in this area are the idea of completing the first biennial greenhouse gas emission reduction assessment, also completing a first inventory of high potential greenhouse gases, and then finally working with the Midwest Governors Association along with the Department of Commerce to analyze the potential for a regional greenhouse gas cap and trade program and also a regional low carbon fuel standard. So there's a lot of things going on in this area, and I think the state is taking the whole climate change and greenhouse gas reduction effort seriously in this state. This is just a plot to show. If you look back, and this is on the x-axis, the lower, the horizontal axis here, what you're seeing is between 1979 and 2007. And what you're seeing here is, again, it does show when you're looking at the primary kind of criteria pollutants that we've been dealing with in the state, you're seeing reduction. And those two that have come down from where they were above the national ambient air quality standards and come down below, the one blue line there is dealing with carbon monoxide. The other lighter blue line there is SO2, sulfur dioxide. And so we see that going through and into the late 80s, early 90s, we got below the national ambient air quality standard. On the other side, you're seeing how things are changing, though. Off on the right, when you look at that line, the thicker horizontal line, that's the national ambient air, you see now two new plotted graph or elements of the graph. And one is dealing with the PM2.5 on an annual basis and PM2.5 on a daily. And that just says that now we're aware that it's the finer particulate are especially of concern, and especially looking at unusually sensitive groups. So again, it's showing that we keep advancing the idea of what should we be even looking at and monitoring in order to make sure that we're actually protecting the health of the people in this state.
Senator Rummel.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And this is a question mostly to help us think about some of the future initiatives we might take. So I recognize that the downturn in lead, that was the shifting to unleaded gasoline, do you think?
Yes.
And the downturn in the sulfur and the carbon monoxide, what was the intervention that brought about this particular change?
Well, I think the Madam Chair and Senator Rummel, I think on the SO2, it was on point, you know, power plants and other things, a lot of the stuff that went into place to deal with the SO2 emissions and the low sulfur coal and other things like that. I think on the carbon monoxide, if I'm correct, it basically a lot of that had to do with automobiles and what was happening with the reduction, higher efficiency, and emission controls on automobiles.
So those are emission controls.
Yep.
It is impressive that when we do intervene, we can make such significant changes. And then would you tell me what PM2.5 and PM annual and daily, what is that you're...
It's just the size. It's particulate matter.
Just the particulate.
And what it is before it was PM10, 10 micron size, and now it's 2.5. So it's just saying that actually what they're finding out is they have to look at the smaller size particulate is really of the concern.
So are these particulates, what substances, any or all?
It can be coming from a number of different sources. One of them, and that's why we're looking at diesel fuels, one of those things where the emissions did have some of the fine particulate dealing with it. And so that was one of the things where we have been focusing on diesel emissions and retrofitting those engines to come up with much better controls.
Thank you.
Senator Rummel, if you'll recall, in the Energy Committee, we had some testimony about this issue as well, not specifically related to attainment standards, but to reaching our greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals. And we were told that the biggest cause of the CO2 reduction was the MERP project, a conversion of the metro plants from two of the oldest coal plants in the Twin Cities from coal to natural gas. And those are also two big sources of particulate emissions. So I'm guessing that some of these other factors are related to that MERP conversion as well.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Mr. Shirkin.
Very good point. Very good.
And Madam Chair, exactly. I just think it, every once in a while it's good for us to reinforce that the interventions do make a difference.
Senator Sacksock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, so I'm assuming on that PM10, when we see those peaks and valleys, that those probably had something to do with a large power plant coming on and off, or?
Madam Chair and Senator Sacksock, I think also it can deal with just the climate, and it's somewhat climate related to how things change and the fluctuations year to year on, you know, the temperature and other things that do have some effect on that, on dealing with it. I'll look and see if there's other things that, you know. That's one of the things in the environmental area. Again, there's a lot of factors that are at play. But certainly, that's why you look over the long term and see if the trend's in the right direction. So it even can take away some of those climate perturbations or other things. So. And again, I'll shift to the next one I think is interesting as well. And this is, again, the air quality index is important, so we can let people know about how clean their air is in different areas. And you'll see basically what we have here plotted on bar graph is the idea of different cities in the state and the idea of both how many healthy good days where the index is above the healthy level or days where it's moderate where there has to be some type of concern, and then also how many days where there's actually some type of a warning for unusually sensitive groups. And again, even though our standards are set so basically to protect sensitive groups, the idea is we still report out so we can help people understand that the reality is on a given day it maybe is at a level that an unusually sensitive group has to be especially cautious and stay indoors in order to prevent any risk with bad health. So, and again, the big thing here is the need to reduce NOx and SOx, SOx and NOx as they're called, and that helps reduce the fine particulates and helps. Really? That's a key correlation to the number of poor days you may have reported in an area. One other thing I'd like to bring up is you'll see here over on the right, even with you're looking at Rochester and Twin Cities, there is that idea that I mentioned before that sometimes some of the air quality in our state is impacted by things coming from south of our border. So you'll see that little variation in some of the quality of the air in areas such as Rochester and Twin Cities that are closer to the southern border and possibly what can be an influence from outside the state. So the next one, and this is kind of a new measurement tool, so it's still in the development phases, but what we're trying to do, this really relates, and it says on the top, air emission reductions as a result of permitting. What we're trying to do is also keep track of the reductions we're seeing in the different pollutants. Again, you'll see on the horizontal scale there, you have particulate matter 10, carbon monoxide, through our permitting activities. So we're trying to understand either through our operating permits, the limits, or through our new facility or modifications where there may be new source requirements and other things, what type of reductions in pollutants are we seeing? So we can also over time understand how our permitting activity is contributing to the quality of the air statewide or as we're looking at it in different communities in the state. So it's also something that is important. This is a tool we hope can be refined over time. So maybe it's a little easier to understand and see the connections between the amount of control we're getting through our permit activity and what it means relative to quality. Next one goes to the idea of our expenditures by fund. And what you'll see here again is the total air program budget appropriations that we're looking at under the governor's recommendation is a little under $26 million, and basically primarily that's going into environmental fund and dealing with the air permitting programs and, again, the compliance and enforcement programs. So that's where the majority of the funds are going from here. There's a small amount of funds that are going into the federal area under this overall category. With that, I could stop a second, but ready to move into water. Again, water-rich state, it's not hard that this is a very important vision for our state. And the idea is Minnesota has clean, sustainable surface and groundwater. And so you look at the different goals we have set here, they really relate to the idea. First, we need water quality standards that are used to assess the health of lakes and streams. We basically set those standards, and it's a almost continual agency effort at the agency, again, given a water-rich state like Minnesota. Then once we have those standards are set, we look at whether those standards are being met. And then if not, if it's a lake or a stream, then those waters are considered impaired and need to be cleaned up. At the present time, approximately 40% of the waters tested in Minnesota did not meet standards, and therefore they have been listed as impaired. However, that goes to the issue, and we'll get into that, of monitoring and assessment. As of now, we've only really been able to assess approximately 14% of our streams and about 18% of our lakes. So, again, one of the big pushes and focuses is on completing and getting a comprehensive look across the state at having an assessment of both lakes and streams. And I'll be talking about that in that 10-year goal we have. Next one, if you look at the different components, again, using that model of prevention, management, and cleanup, again, you can see that the majority here and about one-third of the staff is water quality staff in the agency. And again, the majority here is in the management area, and that's either assessment, TMDL development, or permitting. However, we do consider the stormwater management as a prevention activity, and that's very important. We have three different types of permits now. They're industrial, they're municipal, and their construction permits. So again, a key thing now is looking at activity on the land and how we can prevent it from having an impact on water quality. And also you see at the bottom on enforcement, part of that what we consider is TMDL implementation. Not only do you figure out what needs to happen in an area and a watershed in order to restore the waters, but then the implementation is actually in an implementation plan, laying out who needs to do what. Go forward here again, water program at a glance. Certainly, we still have a lot of the point source activities, and that's the water quality permitting, compliance, and enforcement. But again, more and more it gets into this idea where we are in Minnesota and have the most water of the 48 states in the continent. And again, the idea here is that it takes a lot not only to deal with the point sources, but again, it's quite an effort to monitor and assess the quality. And then as a result of that, we either need to restore waters or protect the waters. And I'll be talking here about the watershed approach that we are now using to do that in a state as big as ours. And what I wanted to do here, though, is just staying on permitting. A key issue with permitting over the years has always been the timeliness of our permits. We have about 1,530 permits for point source dischargers in the state. And right now what we've been trying to do, and I think have been very successful as far as our improvement, is the timeliness of the permits. And we call it our backlog. How many permits basically expire before they are reissued? And the idea is we should have current permits, so we've set a goal of having only a 10% backlog. And right now we are below that. And you see here where that horizontal line, they're at 90%, and we're above that line. And again, we've come up and have come up with great improvement efforts, and our staff trained both on the municipal side and the industrial side in order to get our permits out and have good, timely permits out so that we're making sure that as standards are changing, requirements are changing, the permits reflect those changes that we're dealing with. Also, though, that there still is issue. We'll probably never get to the 0% simply because, again, there's contested permits. There's permits that require us to do special studies, look at non-degradation issues. So there's a lot of permits that take extra time and can interfere with this backlog issue simply because, again, in this state, we have a lot of people interested in permit issues and involved. And in that area, you can end up in hearings, court cases, and others. And I'm sure you've heard of some of those over the last couple of years that we've been dealing with. Next one, again, I'm going to go very quickly, Madam Chair, in this area of water, because I know Senator Rummel is looking at some hearings coming up on this whole area of impaired water. So I will try to go over this quickly on the assumption that some of this will be going into much further detail at those others, but certainly available for questions. Key thing I wanted to say on this slide is that idea, important component of our impaired waters program is the monitoring and assessment. And basically, the strategy now of the agency, and that's consistent with the governor's recommendation, is to come up with a 10-year cycle to cover the state. And the idea is to do that with ECA monitoring by other agencies and local governments, have remote sensing, and also have citizen monitoring. To cover the priority waters. That doesn't mean we're monitoring everywhere, but it means we're gathering data that allows us to have what we believe is a confident assessment of the quality of the waters in the state, looking at the 81 watersheds that we are focusing on. Next one. Again, the monitoring, and what we're looking at is coming up with, again, the 2010 and 11 monitoring. The idea is fourfold, continued watershed monitoring approach. So for the money we're looking at in FY 10 and 11 is for looking at four watersheds being covered in FY 10 and seven in FY 11. It also is looking at pass-through funding to local groups because a considerable amount of this will be done by locals. It's also continued endocrine-disrupting chemical investigations. Again, that's that idea from pharmaceuticals, from our healthcare products and other things. We're looking at endocrine-disrupting chemicals, and there's a big concern that we have a better handle on what are the levels throughout the state of those type of chemicals, and then enhanced groundwater monitoring to support drinking water protection needs. We're, again, and it's important focus of our agency and our work with other agencies is focusing on not just surface waters, but groundwaters, which, again, are a water quality or drinking water supply for a significant number of people in our state. Here, what you're seeing is, again, we're trying to break this down on a few slides that are looking at both streams and lakes. And what you can see here is, again, what the ramp up we'd like to see relative to stream monitoring over the next couple of years. So this projects out through 2011 how we will see the move up from the levels we were at in 2006 and 2007. There is one thing I want to note is that second bar on from the right-hand side, you'll see that down, and that is a result of the idea of the Clean Water Fund, the 3A's tax, and the idea of how it comes in and when we'll actually see the revenue stream being available. So right now, this looks at spending the money that we think will be available, and there will be a little reduction in 2010 as a result of the fact that that stream doesn't start up at the full level right away. So that's there, but I also want to say that a key part of this is local and citizen monitoring are a key component of this, and in a future slide, we'll get into that a little more.
As far, Mr. Schirkenbach, are you prepared to address the whole issue of supplanting on this, on clean water funding? I mean, do you guys have sort of a an official position on that?
As we get into it, I think what we understand what that principle is, and I think what we're trying to do is with the additional activity, it's not supplanting things that were done before, it's adding on to that. So we're supplementing the activities that were happening before, but there is an issue with the one-term money. Actually, Madam Chair, why don't we get Myrna Hall back up,
sure.
our CFO, Chief Financial Officer, to address that.
Madam Chair, members, before I do that one, I'll just go back a little bit to the water question you asked earlier, what the FY08-09. And that biannual budget was at $116 million. The biennium that we're looking at is $105 million. And that difference really is about the Clean Water Fund and the difference between the one-time funding that we achieved, Clean Water Legacy, and this funding scenario where the money coming in will not be available at the same rate that we're going. We do believe that even with this, we still will not be off our 10-year cycle. So even though we show the reduction, we will still be maintaining the 10-year. Our premise is that one-time money goes away and that the Clean Water Fund does not supplant anything because the one-time money disappears. And so that this is new funding, new work to continue that work started.
What about cuts? We haven't gotten to those recommended cuts yet.
We will get to those cuts, and we will explain what they're doing and what the Clean Water Fund does. And the Clean Water Fund that we have here is not replacing any of those funds that were that are being cut in the water programs under the general fund.
Okay, so the reduction there in 2010 is based on losing the one-time money?
It's essentially the one-time money disappears, as you know, the general fund disappears. The tax that's going in place, that revenue stream doesn't come in until, you know, starting into August. And working with management and budget, being cautious to see just exactly what the tax revenue would be, we're not funding a complete year of activity. We're funding about a half a year activity.
Thank you, Ms. Halbach.
One thing I'll focus on here, because you'll see a little difference between the stream monitoring as far as citizen and volunteer contribution, is again the difference between the maroon and the light color on the bar charts is, again, that's the amount of citizen lake and local monitoring that is being done. And if we can go to the lake one, I'll show you. This is showing basically how we see the level and the ramp up as far as the amount of lakes that we're going to be covering for a year. And you'll see here, understandable, people have probably heard of the Citizen Lake Monitoring Program, where we have a very heavy involvement from citizens and locals in our lake monitoring effort that we're seeing here. Again, the MPCA is going to be focused on monitoring, assessing lakes of 500 lake acres and larger. And by the end of 2009, we have sufficient data to assess more than 35% of the lakes in the state that are 500 acres and larger on dealing with it. And this lake monitoring currently is focusing on recreational use, but indicators for biological integrity are also being developed and underway by the Department of Natural Resources. So that's something we will be looking at in the future as we deal with that. We have a question.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, did you say 2009 you project you will have covered 35%?
We will. Madam Chair and Senator Rummel, yes, the idea is we'll have sufficient data to assess more than 35% of the lakes that are over 500 acres.
And is that above the 14% that have already been assessed?
That would be including those that were covered before, but it would give us a cumulative 35% of the lakes over 500 acres.
Thank you for the clarification.
And Chair, this is looking at monitoring by watersheds. And again, one of the main ideas here is finally covering the state by looking at the 81 major watersheds. And so the idea here, as you'll see, is how we'll ramp up on the number of major watersheds that we will have monitored. And the idea is on a 10-year cycle covering all the watersheds. And that does a couple different things. Then you start going back through that cycle, and it gives you efforts to see on the trends. But also, as you're dealing with TMDLs, doing the studies and then the implementation, it even allows you to start seeing what are the results of doing the TMDL, both studies and implementation. So we think that this major watershed cycle that we're looking at is a very efficient and an effective way to dealing with the monitoring issue for a state this size and the number of both streams and lakes that we're dealing with. And so I think it provides us with great coverage and in a very cost-effective way on dealing with that. Next one, so addressing impaired waters. And just cover this, and again, this will be covered further, I think, with Senator Rummel in the hearings. But again, impaired waters are waters not meeting water quality standards. Impaired waters must have a total maximum daily load study. That is language, and the next slide will get into that out of the Clean Water Act. And again, the idea is the TMDL determines that this study, the cause of the problem, and it starts to identify, again, then the factors that have to be looked at to come up with a solution to that problem. And again, here's actually out of the federal law. It's the maximum amount of a specific pollutant that can be discharged to a water body and still meet water quality standards. And so this is a federal language. But the next one really, I think, helps give a better picture of what this is about. And I would say that this is almost like a diet concept. In a sense, these pie charts shows you look at the pie on the left is about what is the load going in and the current conditions. And you basically say, almost like a diet for waters, how do you have to reduce the amount of pollutants that are going in
so you can get that water body to healthy status. The two things, though, you'll see there that are additional elements that are considered is, one is that margin of safety. And it's the last two bulleted items under the on the graph. And one is the margin of safety, and it basically says we know these tools aren't perfect, so you usually build in a margin of safety, so you're kind of taking a precautionary or conservative view. And also you build in a reserve capacity, and it basically says you can't just go right up to the limit now. You have to look at future growth in the area. So you even decide what is a reasonable reserve capacity to build into your reduction efforts so growth and development can continue in an area to some extent in the future, and you aren't capping it at that moment in time. So the development progress, and I think this is important to understand. 5 years ago, there were no TMDLs completed in the state, and relatively few were underway. Here's what you see is there. We now have 98 TMDL studies that have covered 409 listings underway. There have been 20 TMDL completed, covering 145 impairments, and you've had that statewide TMDL for mercury completed that covered 998 impairments. So I think we're on schedule for starting TMDL studies, and again, 80% of this is passed through to locally led TMDL. So again, we're seeing great both progress and also great local involvement, two key indicators as far as how things are going in the state and how we've really started to move ahead. This next plot basically shows the TMDL project ramp up, and it just shows we think this is projections based upon the governor's recommended FY10 and 11 budgets. And again, what you're seeing here is, again, we've got a nice, I think, with the money coming through and the way the agency and other agencies are working together, again, we can see that the progress is going to be there, and the agency is going to be able to meet our goals as far as moving ahead and coming up and meeting the federal standards as far as completing TMDLs. And finally, you look at what we project for what's being bought for FY10 and 11. And we're looking at approximately 60 additional TMDL studies, about 70% of impairments addressed by TMDL projects underway. And that's impairments from the 2008 impaired waters list, and meeting the target of completing TMDLs for 60 impaired waters per year, which is kind of the rate we feel we need to have to go if we're going to be successful over the long term in dealing with the impaired waters issue. And again, that's the EPA target of completing 60 per year for 2010 and 11. Next one, additional item here. We're working with other state agencies to also develop an interagency approach to track effectiveness on implementing the Clean Water Legacy Act. And again, this is important. Each of the agencies has measures, but what we are doing is the agencies are working with the U of M to develop a framework. And that framework is to look at how can we look at the overall effectiveness of dealing with the Clean Water Act. There's a lot of money going into this. It's important to the state, so we think it's important that there's an accountability. So they're looking at a framework that will have four different types of measures, and you see those there. Organizational performance, partnerships and leveraging, social indicators, and environmental outcomes. And we're now developing the specific measures that would fit under those categories. And I think the next one gets into one that I was questioning, what do you mean by social indicators? And this will show you one of the elements under there is the idea of citizens' involvement. How are volunteers participating in the program? And here you can already see a plot that shows some of the participation rates and how they've grown over the years. And again, I think this is, again, showing that the commitment and the engagement that we're getting around the state has been tremendous on these type of things. And that's what it's going to count on, because it's everybody's waters, and I think we know that they're important to everybody in the state, and you're seeing that through this type of a social indicator. So I think that's a very important thing, and I think this is a great effort to make sure that not only are we reporting back on specific things such as TMDLs, but even these type of effective measures that we're going to have to be staying strong if we're going to have a sustainable approach as we move forward. So next one, getting into a little of the governor's recommended budget in this area.
Excuse me. Mr. Schirkenbach, Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the slide before, two slides back, I guess. 1 minute. One more. When you're talking about covering all these TMDLs, are these also by your watershed districts? Are you
Yes, these are also being done on a watershed basis.
So the stream monitoring, the lake monitoring, and the TMDLs are all going to be done together by watershed districts?
No. And that will be going. They're different cycles. All of them aren't necessarily coinciding, but we can explain in each one of those areas what the cycle is looking like and what's happening. But they all don't coincide.
If someone's speaking.
Excuse me. Yes, Madam Chair, I think what we'll get is Galen Reitz up here.
Great. All right, Mr. Reitz, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Galen Reitz. I'm the director of the Regional Division at the PCA. The approach that we do is working through local units of government to do the TMDL studies. 80% of the projects or the TMDL studies that we've done now have involved local units of government. They might be joint powers of counties. They might be watershed districts, soil and water conservation districts, cities, or a combination of those. In the 20% where we don't have a local unit of government, for example, the Lake Pepin project is of such a scale, it's almost half of the state. So we end up being the lead organization in that and then involve other groups in various roles in the project. So that's how the 80-20 comes about. But the emphasis is on having a local project sponsor, because once you do the TMDL study, to do the implementation activities, it's really important that there be that local commitment and ownership of moving the whole effort forward.
Senator Rummel.
And I appreciate this. I realize I'm coming to this a little later than many of you, so it might be redundant. But so as I understand it, the monitoring of the lakes and streams, is that done by watershed districts?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, watershed districts only cover about a little over a third of the state districts as far as a government unit. We are doing the monitoring following the watershed boundaries. So there are 81 major watershed boundaries in the state, and that is the focus of the approach that we're taking. And so the monitoring is following that approach. The TMDL development, we are actually transitioning to that approach, and the implementation will also follow that.
But go ahead, Senator Rummel.
I think one clarification on language, watershed district versus watershed boundary, that helps me. And then that these are, the assessment of the lakes and streams is one thing, and then the TMDLs is operating on a different schedule or different parallel because of the way the work is done.
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, that's correct. Right. Basically, we are doing some of the monitoring occurs throughout the state annually. Some of it follows through the state on that 10-year cycle. So we're doing roughly 8 of the major watersheds a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then we take some time to assess the data, evaluate it, and then the TMDL study effort follows that, and then the implementation follows that once the plan is in place.
Can't imagine how helpful that is.
Well, Senator Rummel, it's helpful, but I'm still a little confused. So I appreciate you're asking really good questions. So if you have a TMDL in a particular watershed, what you're saying is that there could be more than one TMDL in a given watershed that covers different bodies of water, and they overlap. That's the part I'm having trouble with, because I just sort of assumed they would be there'd be one for each area.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, basically we've been on an approach where we've really been doing segment by segment, parameter by parameter.
Mm-hmm.
For efficiency purposes, we're transitioning to an approach where we look at the entire watershed. There are many commonalities in that area. Instead of going segment by segment, we're seeing that we can gain efficiency by doing the watershed, doing both the identifying the impairments, but also developing protection plans at the same time with the intention of getting ahead of it. So those, we often cite the statistic that of the waters we've monitored, about 40% are impaired, 60% aren't. So the intention is get ahead of it so that we protect that 60% that aren't impaired. Don't let them become impaired. Back to the ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure concept. So hopefully we can get ahead of the whole process and not wait until water bodies are impaired to start being concerned about them.
But where do lakes fit into this? Because when you're talking about segments, you know, usually when we talk about TMDLs, we're talking about streams and rivers that are moving downstream. But lakes are part of TMDLs traditionally, or they will be under your watershed approach only?
They have been included. They've been done one by one. We will be moving to including them in within that watershed area. And for the most part, you know, lakes have outlets that flow, become streams, and so we'll be doing it as a system, not one by one individually.
And Senator Rummel, you asked another question that never really occurred to me before, but watershed district boundaries, are they pretty much concurrent with counties? Are they related to watershed boundaries? Are they geographically, or are they sort of neither or both?
Madam Chair, watershed district boundaries follow the watershed boundaries for the most part. There's some minor, for convenience, they might follow, you know, some other
political boundary
also. But for the most part, they are set up following the watershed boundary.
We should get a map of them. Yeah, I haven't looked at that before. That's a good question. Senator Rummel.
So, Madam Chair, I'm sorry I didn't get your name.
Galen Reitz.
Mr. Reitz, it is possible that watersheds overlap more than one county.
Madam Chair, that is correct. And Senator Rummel, that is correct.
Great. Thank you. Go ahead, please, Mr. Schirkenbach.
Okay, Madam Chair, committee. Again, first, I apologize. I wasn't listening. I did not catch that distinction on the question about the districts versus the watersheds. So I apologize. That was it. And nobody should feel the questions were great questions. Every time I listen relative to this approach, I'm learning something new because it is complicated when you look at all the different elements as far as geographical boundaries, the watersheds, and the different issues we're addressing from monitoring to the TMDL to the implementation. So I think by going into that in greater detail, that'll be something very beneficial to everybody. And I think we're here on the governor's recommended budget on dealing with this. And this is, again, showing the expenditures by fund and great addition by Myrna as far as talking about the difference between the 08-09 versus this 10 and 11 budget. This is at $105.5 million as the governor's recommendation. And as you can see here, the different expenditures that will involve, and again, the Clean Water Fund under this is about 35% or $37.2 million is what's covered under that overall budget.
And the Clean Water Revolving Fund, remind us the sources of that fund.
That is actually, again, that is money that comes through the PFA, Public Facilities Authority, and that's through the idea of lower interest loans and that type of thing for communities and for other type of projects dealing with it. And again, the last area I'll cover here, and then we will get into the issue of some of the change levels and stimulus. Administrative support, and this is just covering, showing the seven different areas that we include under our administrative support area, including our citizens board, commissioner's office, and then we have the normal different operational areas that most agencies have as far as accounting, human resources, information systems, etc. And again, this is showing, and again, $32.5 million, and this is showing the governor's recommended budget on how those expenditures are spread out. And again, key thing I want to point out here is, again, this is you know, less than 10% of the overall budget that we're looking at. So I think we've, again, tried very much to be bringing our continuous improvement not just to our environmental programs but to also our operational areas, because we see it's very important that we keep these at efficient, sustainable levels as dealing with them. And here I'd like to go into the budgetary change items. And the first one is something you were referring to, Madam Chair, as far as the general fund reduction. So the governor recommends a general fund appropriation reduction of $1.15 million. Again, that's in, part of that is in the Clean Water Partnership, and what we're looking at is a reduction of $850,000 in that area. That's roughly, we're assuming that'll come out to be about 3 to 5 projects that we will not be undertaken that would have otherwise. And again, some of the other reduction is basically in just operational budgets, both in administrative support and in the environmental assistance and cross-media operations. So that's what we're seeing in general fund.
So the Clean Water Partnership reductions, those will not be funded in the future year?
That'll be, Madam Chair, that is correct. Those will actually be reduction in projects.
So how much, I mean, you're not cutting the whole program, are you?
No, we're not
you're
cutting the whole program.
And,
yeah, we're just moving some making some reduction there in what we see as 3 to 5 projects that would have been covered.
Out of how many total?
Right now,
the overall amount of money in that area.
Madam Chair, it's been about $5 million for the biennium in the past.
Okay, it'd be helpful
to
know how many.
It's about a 20% reduction.
Okay, it'd be nice to know how many projects are funded now and if you have designated certain ones to be eliminated.
Okay, Madam Chair, we can get that information. Here, why don't we have Galen come up again?
Sure.
Galen, what was his last name? Reed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in 2004 and 5, we had about 23 projects. 2006 and 7, about 19. And in this past biennium, also about 19 projects. So the reduction of 3 to 5. Some of the projects, you know, continue for some years. I think the reductions we're looking at here would include shortening the time frame of our commitment to some of the projects.
It's different. So you're cutting 3 to 5 projects, so the projects aren't going away? You're reducing them?
Well, some of the projects have the opportunity to have a continuation grant if they don't finish in 2 years, mm-hmm. to extend it to a second set of 2 years. And so some of the, you know, we would not necessarily start new projects, and it comes out to an average of a reduction of 3 to 5 projects. But the other thing that we're also doing with the Clean Water Partnership program now is moving an emphasis to protection activities through this program, and the emphasis there is that. Again, getting ahead of problems and trying to solve problems before you have a significant decrease in water quality in these projects.
So, can you give us a little more specifics about what the grants are used for? What, how much per grant? What activities specifically are funded with them?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Clean Water Partnership is set up. It's again a grant to local units of government to lead a project. They really have two phases. First is a development of a diagnostic feasibility study where they go in and study the specific water resource, identify what kind of activities they need to protect and improve that water body, and then set about making those improvements. These projects, I think through the Clean Water Partnership projects is where we gained a lot of our knowledge on how to move forward doing the TMDL projects. The Clean Water Partnership projects, none of them actually are TMDLs. These have been projects that haven't necessarily, or we haven't used Clean Water Partnership project funds to fund TMDL studies per se.
Okay, and how much are the grants generally?
The grants range depending on the size of the project. A small lake project with a small watershed, diagnostic studies may range from $30,000 to $60,000. To some of the bigger projects, such as the Redwood Cottonwood River, where it's a very large river, have, you know, the diagnostic portion of the study may have been in the range of a couple $100,000, and then the implementation activities that have followed that have ranged, you know, significantly more.
So you
up to $1 million.
So you fund some of the implementation out of these grants as well?
Yes.
So what, I guess what we need to know is sort of what are we going to be losing if you make these cuts, so we can decide if we agree with them or not. What's at stake here? Won't get done?
Madam Chair, we can certainly come back and show you the number of applications we've got in the last funding round and how far we've been able to go on that, as examples of the types of projects that may or may not get funded.
Okay. And then it's, again, in the governor's recommended budget with the Clean Water Fund, is there funding for clean water partnerships in the future years?
Madam Chair, the Clean Water Partnership has always been funded out of the general fund. There is not funding from the new Clean Water Fund proposed in the governor's budget.
So how will we expand the work that's done at the community level by those local governments to do those kinds of studies with the new money? I mean, how are we going to make sure that that expands? I mean, that's with the new money, we need to expand what we're already doing. Is there a different approach to it with the new dollars?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what's proposed in the governor's budget is the watershed framework, which I very briefly described, where basically we would look at assessment around the state, doing TMDL or doing a major watershed plan, which would identify both those impaired waters and the unimpaired waters, and then develop an implementation plan to go about making those improvements.
And will that be delivered through a local grant program to local governments?
Madam Chair, as I had mentioned before, the focus is on having local partners in those efforts. And it wouldn't be the same type of application cycle because we're moving around the state. We're, you know, going to cover the whole state through that process, whereas the Clean Water Partnership has been from local project sponsors coming in and proposing a project that they're interested in doing on focusing on a specific water body.
So you're going to decide which watersheds to go to instead of having the local folks drive that choice?
Madam Chair, we will be covering the whole state with the assessment process and the planning process. We will be working with the local units of government to they will be making the decisions on where they place the emphasis on where they do the implementation activities as far as how they focus their implementation activities in their watershed.
Okay. So can you tell us what do you call that new approach? I mean, in the budget specifically, which program are we talking about?
Madam Chair, it's listed in the budget as the water quality monitoring and assessment and also the TMDL development are the line item categories.
Okay, but that's new. That's a new program, or is that additional to what is already general fund
Madam
funded?
Chair, it's it.
That sounds like what we already are doing in the base budget, but this is...
Well, it's what we did with the one-time funds after the Clean Water Legacy Act was passed. You gave us one-time funds in 2007, 2008, and 2009, which there was no money proposed in the out years beyond that. So we always knew that there would have to be some other source that would be created to provide funding to that. And so we're hopeful that it's the Clean Water Funds.
All right, so just going back, you said, okay, and maybe it was Mr. Schirkenbach who said This 850,000 represents the 3 to 5 projects and those other two categories, water operations and administration, or that's beyond the 8? The 850 is just for the Clean Water Partnership. Okay.
That is beyond the 850 then,
okay,
that we're talking about. Yes, so, Madam Chair.
All right, so I'm looking at the budget pages here and trying to figure out where we're at. On page 12, okay, the governor's recommending a reduction of $1.15 million. That is $950,000 from the water program, $100,000 environmental assistance and cross media, and $100,000 in administrative support. Do you want to comment on those other two areas besides the Clean Water Partnership?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll have Lyle comment on that.
Oh.
Madam Chair, you were looking at which page?
Page 12.
Oh, yeah, that's 100 more. Yeah. This was only 850. Okay, so the water portion of it is actually 950. So where does the other 100 go, or come from, rather?
Madam Chair, that's correct. The reduction to the water program is 950 per year, and the remaining of that, the remaining 100,000, is essentially our effort to manage this reduction through position cuts. We are proposing a couple of ideas internally. One would be the reduction of a hydrologist, another in combination with a halftime engineer. The work essentially would be redistributed and divided up between other existing staff.
Okay, and those are vacant positions, or those are existing? Those are layoffs?
Madam Chair, they are not layoffs. Currently, they are vacant positions. All of the reductions that you will hear us talk about today are vacant positions that we are proposing to reduce in the future. We're not talking about any layoffs.
Okay. Well, then I guess when we get to the next couple pages where we talk about the new funds, we need to know if you're hiring any additional hydrologists or engineers in the future, the new money. So we can maybe get to that when we get to that page.
Okay.
But the rest of the reductions then were $100,000 and then $100,000 from two other the operations.
Madam Chair, right. That's both in that environmental assistance and cross-media operations and also in the administrative support operation. What it basically means is, again, we try to do a very good job of managing the sequencing of filling vacancies that were positions that we're going to fill. And we use the salary savings or other money through those. So what we do is we feel that we'll just have to continue to do that to make up $100,000 in the environmental assistance and cross media operations and $100,000 in the administrative support operations. So.
Okay, and again, those are vacant positions that won't be filled.
It could either be through. Go ahead,
Madam Chair. Yes, those are current positions that are vacant. As you know, the general fund shows up in our budget in the three programs. In addition to the water program, the environmental assistance and cross media, and in the administrative support, and in all of those areas, $100,000 per year, $200,000 in environmental assistance and cross media. Again, we're proposing reductions in positions currently vacant, funded positions, and in administrative support the same.
Will that have any impact on delivery of services that you can point to?
Madam Chair, in the case of the environmental assistance and cross media, the position that's been identified is in the area of solid waste planning. Again, what we're proposing is that the work will need to be or will be assessed, reevaluated, redistributed to existing staff. In the case of the position in the admin support area, we are working seriously to take a look at a reduction. This is a manager position that will be reduced. Of course, anytime you lose a position, there is some level of impact that ends up being, the work ends up being distributed to others in the agency.
Okay. And how long, do you know how long these positions have been vacant?
Madam Chair, it really varies. They're currently vacant. Some are very recent. Others have been vacant for longer.
So in some cases, other people are already filling the gap. And in some cases, maybe that's not the case.
Madam Chair, that would be correct. It depends upon. And often in a job, they'll have a number of different responsibilities, so it depends upon how you're looking at filling those gaps with other people chipping in on doing that.
Okay, well, we're almost out of time, and we're pretty much just wrapping up the general fund portion of the budget cut, the change item. So I apologize that we're going to have you come back. But I appreciate people asking good questions. That's what we're here for. That's our job. So don't be shy about that.
No,
so,
Madam Chair, I appreciate that, too. It was a good discussion.
Absolutely. And, yes, Senator Vickerman.
In about 2 minutes, I'm going to have to go to a budget division to make cuts.
Yeah.
Well, I want to know, when they come back, what can we cut? We've got to make some cuts. There's no way we're going to get there. I want those cuts to be to do the least harm. That's just a suggestion. Instead of me guessing, I want you to come back and tell me what you can do to help us get out of this mess we're in.
Madam Chair, we will.
Mr. Shirkenbach.
Senator Vickerman, yes, we will be responsive to that request.
All right. Well, I think we'd probably like you to come back Tuesday if that's possible for our regular committee hearing.
Madam Chair, we'll do whatever we need to do to accommodate that. So.
Our administrator's sick today, but we'll make sure we get back to you quickly with the schedule.
Thank you
very much.
Thank
Members,
you.
We'll be here on Tuesday. Meeting's adjourned.
Good day.
We're going to have a judiciary.
We have some bills.